From the Sky News Centre at 5, it's being reported that a British woman has been decapitated in a supermarket in Tenerife. The Foreign Office say they're urgently investigating. Police have arrested a homeless Bulgarian man in the town of Los Cristianos. Colin Kirby is a journalist who lives on the island and saw the man leaving the shop.
A security guard and a couple of other people gave chase. They tried to sort of lunge at him, like a rugby tackle. He slipped out and moved on a bit more, and then they got him. They managed to bring him down and restrained him.
Network Rail has apologised after it was fined £3 million for the failings that led to the Potter's Bar rail crash. Seven people died when a points failure caused a high-speed train from London to derail in Hertfordshire in 2002. Foreign Secretary William Hague has condemned a double suicide bombing in Pakistan as cowardly and indiscriminate. At least 80 people were killed when the bombers attacked recruits leaving a paramilitary training centre in the northwest of the country. The Taliban say it's revenge for the killing of Osama bin Laden. Fox News correspondent Dominic Di Natale, who is in Islamabad, says the number of people is likely to rise.
The latest casualty figures we have are now well in excess of 150 injured, 40 of those critically. Not many expected to live. They believe the final death toll could be well above 100 people now.
Downing Street has denied David Cameron's giving preferential treatment to the parents of missing Madeleine McCann. The Prime Minister has asked Scotland Yard to review the files into the child's disappearance. Labour MP Thomas Doherty has written to Scotland Yard asking them to investigate former Treasury Minister David Laws over his expenses. Yesterday, Mr Laws was suspended from the Commons for a week after he was found to have breached rules over paying rent to his partner. And Jedward have made it through to the final of tomorrow night's Eurovision Song Contest. The Irish twins are among the bookies' favourites to win the competition, which takes place in Dusseldorf. They'll have to beat recently reformed British boy band Blue, though. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culkin.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. I'm joined this week by the Green candidate for Cabot Ward in the recent City Council elections. That's Ben Appleby. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as usual, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Princess Diana's tissue samples were swapped at the post-mortem, and she had almost no injuries in the crash itself. Further revelations on the 1997 demise of Princess Diana this week, and we hear from the author of a new book, The British Cover-Up, by Australian author John Morgan. And Tony Blair's press secretary Alistair Campbell and the head of James Bond's secret intelligence service, John Scarlett, has proven to have been cooking up the dodgy dossier on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Well, with millions now dead and displaced, isn't it about time the pair of them went to jail for war crimes? And where to discuss all this? How about Bristol's very own Speaker's Corner on College Green? Stephen Perry will be along to explain why old-fashioned face-to-face political hustings still matter in the city. And following the 7-7 inquest, we have another untold story not touched on at the inquest. The Israeli CCTV firm in charge of London Underground security at the time of the London bombings. And finally, Bristol City Council's statement on potassium iodate tablets. They are the front line of defence against radiation. But why have these once cheap and freely available tablets been taken off the market? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 7 degrees Celsius tonight and some showers, we hope. Highs of 13 Celsius over the weekend, sunny spells and showers. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, but more showery towards the beginning of the week and some sunnier towards the end of the week. Now, I just do have to say that a lot of these showers have not been appearing, so we shall see. And a lot of people looking at their gardens and hoping some of these overnight showers are going to happen. Next weekend, 21st and 22nd of May, highs of 20 Celsius, up warmer, and sunny spells and showers, again, next weekend. So that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, with me this week is Green candidate for Cabot Ward in the recent City Council elections, Ben Appleby. Hi, Ben, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First of all, then, why are you a Green?
Wow, well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I am Green because I think the world and human beings in general face a big problem. And I just don't think that conventional politicians are facing up to the fact that unless we do something, and that something needs to be pretty radical, we as a species are going to face some form of massive population collapse within a generation or two. So I think it's that important. But unfortunately, not every single voter in the country agrees with
me. But quite a few in Bristol do, because you've just got your second councillor in the city. Has that sort of buoyed up party spirits a little bit?
You bet. I mean, why wouldn't it? Yeah, we won Ashley, and we won it big time. You know, we got nearly half the vote in a very tough campaign, and we are absolutely delighted. You know, Gus is going to be a great councillor, and we think that Gus and Tess, our two councillors, can make a difference. So, yeah, we're delighted. That's why we're in politics. I mean, people often think, you know, that those of us who aren't in the big parties are just messing around, and we're just playing at it. But we want to win, and we've shown with Caroline Lucas that we can even crack Parliament winning by first past the post.
She's your first Green MP from Brighton, isn't she?
She's the first Green MP in Brighton, but she's also the first person anywhere in the world to be elected by first past the post to national government. So it's an incredible achievement.
What was this business with first past the post then? Because we've just had this whole referendum all on AV, the alternative vote versus first past the post. Why is it so difficult for small parties like the Greens to break through with that first past the post, the existing system?
Well, the first myth is that AV isn't first past the post. AV is just a form of first past the post. So we, along with the Liberal Democrats, in fact, want proportional representation. Then people's votes really count. But failing that, AV as a form of first past the post was better than the simple system that we use now. But there we are, you know, you've got to let bygones be bygones and get on with it, haven't you?
So it might take a little bit longer for the Greens to emerge as a major party, but anyway, that you can't actually stop this happening, I suppose, ultimately. Anyway, one of the things that you've been involved in over the last few weeks is conversations with the police and obviously the community in Ashley and around Stokescroft over the Tesco disturbances. Could you just tell us what your thoughts are about the two nights we had, the evening before Good Friday and then a week after that in the area with so many arrests and injuries? Well, all based around this Tesco and a squat opposite, of course.
Yeah. I think the first thing to say is that we all abhor violence of all sorts, whether it's the sort of violence you see in Stokescroft or the sort of violence that's happening in Libya or Syria or elsewhere. So, but that doesn't mean that this is a simple case of a lot of rioting young people, or not all of all ages, against our glorious policemen riding to the rescue of the local community. This is a very complex situation. Tesco's does play a part in it. The major thing that they did wrong was alienate the local community by with their planning application and doing it in a sneaky, underhanded way. From there, the situation...
Sorry, can you just explain, in what way was it sneaky and underhanded?
They didn't put their name to the application. Now, if you or I apply for something, generally we'll say, you know, Ben Appleby, Tony Gosling, we're applying to do something. And we would expect to do that. We wouldn't get someone else to say, you know, I don't want to put my name to this, you know, you put it for me, and then when it all comes out in the wash, it will actually be me. Well, Tesco's routinely, I believe, but certainly in this case, did not apply in their own name. Now, whether or not that really makes any difference to the planning process is totally and utterly irrelevant. The fact is that by applying in someone else's name, using some form of subterfuge, it meant that the local community felt cheated. They didn't have they were unable to express themselves properly at the first planning, and that led to resentment that festered. It also, I mean, I met with representatives of Tesco's earlier this week. I think they certainly say that they recognise that this was maybe not what they should have been doing, but it's something they routinely use. So let's see whether they actually change. They're certainly saying they'll change, but will they change? Let's see.
Yeah, there was a lot of police involved in both of these incidents, and a lot of people have been saying that there were too many riot police, for example. 100 or so police were there, not all of them riot police. There were also armed police there. Now, the police would say, of course, I mean, we have invited the Chief Constable, Colin Port, onto this programme several times, and he's refused. But the police would say, in this kind of circumstance, that, that it was necessary to bring all these riot police in just simply to keep order. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts aren't really... I'm not qualified to speak, but I do know that the police have confirmed in the public meeting that I attended that all these policemen were there before anything had happened. So we just take a peaceful, perfectly normal Stokescroft on a Thursday night, a warm Thursday night before a long bank holiday weekend. There were, I believe, 140 policemen in the area before anything happened. Now, this is critical. Was that the correct decision? Now, I'm not an operational policeman. I'm not trying to suggest that I know better. But clearly, it was a factor that the policemen were there before, I stress that, before anything happened. Because there's been lots of myths about this, about when the police arrived, how they assembled the force. Those policemen were there before anything happened.
But surely if they were expecting possible trouble, it was a good idea to have a few police down back alleyways in vans waiting as possible reinforcements that may not necessarily be used.
They were entering a house to arrest one man. The house had four or five occupants. How many policemen do you need to do that? Yes, there is a number that it would be prudent to take for an operation like that. My question is that number 140 or 100, or is it 10
so
or 5?
So do you think that the truth has come out about the various issues involved with this, and what are the Green Party calling for?
No, I don't think the truth has anywhere near come out about this, and Gus, our councillor, or councillor for Ashley, is calling for a full independent inquiry. We're asking everyone to support this, so we've contacted Stephen Williams, the Liberal Democrat MP for the area. We've contacted Kerry McCarthy, who was there. We've asked for support from the Lib Dem councillors in the ward, so that's John Rogers, Alex Woodman and Mark Wright. We don't want to make this political. This is not a political issue. This is the biggest civil event that's happened in Bristol for 30 years, and it needs to be looked into. We can't simply allow a sort of knee-jerk reaction to this to rule the day. We need to look into it. It's multifactorial. We've got the issue of why Stokes Croft has been allowed to become host to a group of people who feel so marginalised. I'm not making any sort of judgmental, anything judgmental about those people, and I've no views on that at all, but it's clear that they do feel marginalised. And why has that been allowed to happen, particularly when the city council itself is a big landlord in the area? Some of these properties have been bought through compulsory purchase orders because the previous landlords were so-called negligent. What has really changed since the compulsory purchase orders went through and the city became that landlord? Not much.
But isn't it a bit unfair to criticise the police, because we can't allow mob rule to be in charge in the city?
Have I criticised the police? I don't think I have. I'm merely saying that what needs to happen is there needs to be a full inquiry. I mean, the police themselves are saying they've had 10 complaints so far. I'm sure that was a week ago today they said that. There was at least one person in that meeting, in fact the man sitting next to me, who said that he would be complaining, and he was sporting a horrible injury from a police dog on his forearm. And there are many others who are frightened to complain because they feel that the police are going to victimise them again. You know, they're frightened of the police. This is wrong. Of course, I'm not trying to defend what went on the night. And things happen when in a disturbance like that. It's a bit like you hear about the smoke of war. I'm sure it's exactly the same. But the fact is that things went on both sides. It's not as simple as saying that there are a whole load of young and old and mixed group of people who suddenly have turned violent on the police for no reason at all. It is not as simple as that. So I'm not trying to offer an explanation other than say that there are many causes to it, of which Tesco is one. But in my view, Tesco is only only one of several components. And that's why we need this inquiry, to unpick what's happened, to ensure that it doesn't happen again. You know, after the riots 30 years ago, there was the Scarman inquiry. This is not something that's been repeated. You know, then we had riots in Bristol and Liverpool and London, and clearly this is not quite the same as that. But we need something similar in Bristol so that we can move forward from this. Because at the moment, people don't feel happy about it on both sides. There are some people who feel that the rioters or people just dishing out some violence. No, actually, that's not true. The violence was on both sides. The violence was on both sides, and that is the thing that I think is being not ignored, but not enough stress is being given to it.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that people don't always feel confident in the police complaints procedure, especially when we've had something like 400 deaths in custody over 10 years with not a single conviction of a police officer for that, despite, you know, obviously 400 complaints made to the police. The other thing, of course, is that we have a sort of track record of problems with the Chief Constable, Colin Port. Back in 2009, he was accused of defying a court order to return computer material seized in a child porn raid on the home of a controversial expert witness who had actually been clear, and the Chief Constable was then cleared of contempt of court. And we ended up with the crazy situation of a High Court bailiff turning up at the home of the Chief Constable, Colin Port, his wife then calling the police, and then there being a standoff between the High Court bailiff and police officers actually outside the home of the Chief Constable. 12 hours before Colin Port was due to appear in the High Court under this contempt of court order, all of the material, these computer hard drives, etc., was returned back to this expert witness. And, you know, this isn't the only occasion. We've also had the Chief Constable, Colin Port, called corrupt by Ian Liddell Granger, MP for Bridgewater, because of a privatisation deal to do with the police civilian support services, which was handled and project managed by his wife, who has kept her maiden name. But, you know, the idea that this has been a problem in the past that hasn't really much been addressed, and this is one of the reasons we've repeatedly asked Colin, the Chief Constable, to come on and explain some of these things and also give his version of events, which he's refused to do so. Well, also Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, is with me too. Martin, what are your thoughts on the sort of fallout from the Stokes Croft disturbances over Easter and a week afterwards?
Well, I think I'd like to congratulate the Green Party for taking the ward. I mean, we were a bit unhappy, obviously, as the Labour Party, but I think it was a good answer by the community to the provocations to which they've been subjected. One of the things I'd like to point out is that if there were petrol bombs on the roof, as the police claim, why was there no fire tender in attendance? We've got people who work in Avon and Somerset Fire Brigade, and they've said that their yard was being used to corral all these police before they went down there, but no fire truck went with them. And the police have not yet proved that there were any petrol bombs of any kind. And the person they are charging with making petrol bombs, we understand to be 20 years old with learning difficulties, and not in the squat at the time. I think the community locally in Stokes Croft are very unhappy with what's happened. I suspect that many people in Trinity, our local police station, are very unhappy with what's happened, because we had forces from out of town, Devon and Cornwall, Wiltshire and South Wales. That certainly was planned in advance. So this whole operation was planned in advance, presumably by Colin Port. At least he's the man responsible. Now, if it turns out that this is a provocation by Tesco's and the police, and people say you can't say things like that, I'm saying it on air now, this is absolutely a suspected provocation. Maybe it's not, maybe it's all an accident, but it looks like a provocation to me. And what people have got to remember is, in the 80s and in the 60s in Northern Ireland, what happens if the police lose the confidence of the local community is pretty scary. I lived in Brixton during both the riots, and it was pretty scary because people had lost all faith in the local police. We don't want to see that happen here.
Now, Green Party candidate for Cabot Ward, Ben Appleby. Ben, what are your thoughts about the ages of the people who were arrested over these two nights of disturbances?
Well, this is another shocking fact. At the same public meeting, I asked Superintendent Julian Moss, who I believe was the person operationally responsible for the policing on those nights, and asked him to confirm my suspicions that a lot of the people that they're arresting are very young, many of them still at school. And he said whilst they had not completed their profiling of those that they had arrested, he did suspect that this may well be true. And I think you've got to see what's happening in the context also of the student demonstrations. Now, the police, I think, were pleased with their operation to control those demonstrations, but my fear is that those operations were treated as a bit of a sort of party by many youngsters who came out of school, ran around, made a nuisance of themselves and got a taste for this, and they thought it was fun, and it isn't, and they're wrong to have thought that, but that's what happened. But you know, I brought this up with the police directly at our neighbourhood forum after that, because the student demos took place in Cabot, and the policeman who attended the neighbourhood forum had been on duty during them. And I asked them, were you pleased? Did you think you've done a good job? And they said, yes, they did. I said, well, what about the liaison with the schools? Don't you think that there's a real problem here, that you had lots of school kids out, you dealt with them pretty harshly? Do you not think that maybe this is going to have consequences? And do you not think it would be good to go back into the schools? Do you not think it would be good to make these children realise that they have to be responsible for their behaviour, but that the police are not just to be targets? The police made themselves targets by policing so heavily, and all the kettling and so on was totally unnecessary for what were very good-natured demonstrations at that time. Certainly in Bristol, there was nothing like the disturbances that took place in London with the Bristol student demonstrations. So, you know, I think that this inquiry that I would call for again should look at the policing of those demonstrations and see what the link is between those and the people that they then subsequently are finding themselves arresting. It's a very traumatic thing for a young person to suddenly find themselves criminalised. I don't think you'll find that some of these people they arrest will have long track records and all the rest of it. It's inevitable. But a lot won't. When they look at what they're actually arresting, it's normal young people from our community. And that's wrong, because it was the situation that sucked them in, that criminalised them. They didn't set out that night to have a great big violent party. They were just out as normal on a Thursday night before a long weekend. And then they got sucked in. And this is, it's very, very wrong, and they shouldn't be demonised.
Now, we hear in The Guardian this week and in the Bristol Evening Post that Tesco is planning to reopen the store any time now. And Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets to find out whether you want Stokescroft Tesco reopened.
Should Tesco reopen their shop on Stokescroft, or should it be open as a corner shop run by local people?
I think they should just keep it as Tesco's, because it's creating more jobs, it's benefiting more people. Okay, there's loads of Tesco's everywhere, we know that, but obviously it is going to help more people, it's a bit more convenient, and I think it should be kept there.
I would say a corner shop run by local people. I think there's not enough variety of local shops. Like, it's really hard to run a small business nowadays without getting someone like Tesco, another big superpower, if you want to call it, taking over and cutting people's jobs off.
I don't have a problem with Tesco, but I don't think they should reopen just because it's not a great place to open. I mean, it's just going to get burnt again, so they really shouldn't reopen.
Well, they're a big enough brand to sort of do what they want, so I think they should open. I mean, it's a free country and it's a free market. That's what it's designed for.
They should have got the message by now, you know, if they're not welcome there. It affects other businesses, and they're a big company. They surely can go somewhere else. A lot of people have expressed their disagreement with the fact they opened up in the first place. So I think they should, like, maybe find somewhere else to open up their store and let local businesses thrive and make money.
I don't know, really, if they should build a Tesco if everyone is against that. And I don't know if they really need them, because here are loads of, like, supermarkets and stuff. So I don't know if they really need them, or if they could walk down here and buy their stuff here.
Are corporations becoming too big and powerful?
Yeah, they are, but they're creating jobs, aren't they? You know what I mean? It's saving people from being on benefits, and I think it's helping people. They are taking over a bit, but they're still helping at the same time. I don't think it's hindering at all.
I saw that Sainsbury's had made billions, and I just thought that was a bit ridiculous. But it's where people want to shop. You can't say, oh, you can't shop here because this company's too powerful. I mean, if they've got the best deals, they've got the best deals. I mean, there's not much you can do about that.
I think they have too much influence in the market. People would rather go to Tesco's and Sainsbury's rather than, say, a local shop, because they know what they get and it's quite consistent what you get in Tesco's and Sainsbury's. Yeah, they probably do have too much power of what goes on.
No, because actually law and legislation against companies becoming too big and too powerful. So, no, they're not. That's the stupid...
I didn't know much about Tesco's finances, but at the same time, I think they've got enough money to open up a store somewhere else.
They're really big and you can buy all your stuff there, so it's a question if you have, like, other companies, they can run their business here as well. I like the supermarket, so it's fine. I think it's fine.
What should be done?
Obviously, if they open Tesco's again, there's probably going to be more and more riots, isn't there? So it'd probably be safer for them to close it for a while, or just arrest everyone that keeps causing problems. I'm not sure.
I think they should always have a minimum number of supermarkets. I mean, at the moment, they've got, say, Tesco, Asda, Sainsbury's. I think they should have a minimum. I mean, Morrison's is coming in now, which is quite good, more competition. Should have a minimum of, say, 10, like they do with banks. They're breaking up Barclays, making them sell a few branches, just so that you have enough competition to keep prices. But apart from that, you can't force people to shop at smaller shops if they don't have what you want, and if the prices aren't great, then they're always going to shop at a larger shop.
Well, I guess people should stop complaining about it. It's what it's there for. Like I said, it's a free market, it's a free country. Tesco are big enough to do what they want. That's it.
That they should find somewhere else to open up. It's not good for the community. Surely they can find somewhere else. There's a lot of disturbance and stuff, so surely they can find.
I think you should listen to what the people say, really. Maybe you could do something for the community in this sort of shop instead of building a Tesco which no one really likes or want there. Something that the people actually like and they can do something with it, like a community centre or sort of...
Okay, that was Marina Morris out on the streets talking to you about what you think about the reopening of Tesco's and whether it should happen or not. And I'm also joined by Green Party representative Ben. What do you think about what you just heard there? So quite a lot of people actually saying what they're saying effectively is that who are you to say that a company can't open there? That it's a powerful company, but they should have the right to be wherever they want. And a lot of people actually quite like Tesco's.
Well, it's complex, like all these things. I think now we've had violence and they have permission to open, it's an unfortunate fact of life that I feel certain that they will reopen, whether that's right or wrong. I think it's inevitable they will reopen. What I would like to say to Tesco's is, given that, I think that they should... take their time, let things settle down, give at least another a month or two, let the Stokescroft Community Festival go past, support this inquiry that we call for, maybe even offer to fund part of the inquiry, make some genuine commitments to the community vis-a-vis the store, and let's get on with life as normal, because Stokescroft is not a violent place. And I think, you know, if Bristol has a reputation in the country, it's not for violence. It's quite the opposite. You know, we are a peaceful city and we're a broad-minded city. And I want us to move on from this. So Tesco's, yeah, I kind of fear it's inevitable that they'll reopen. But please will they not reopen for just a couple of months, maybe... so that things can calm down, support this call for the inquiry, make a donation towards the cost of it, and let's all move on.
Martin, Tesco's up in West Bromwich, as part of their planning permission deal, actually built a police station at the cost of £7 million. Do you think that there is actually any kind of implication in doing things like that, that there is a relationship going on between the police and Tesco's?
Tesco's are not a normal free market company. They're a company with political power. Once you've built a police station, you're in a position to control policing, aren't you? Or at least the suspicion is going to be there. Incidentally, some of those people they were talking about Tesco's being bombed, firebombed. It was not firebombed. It is disputed that there were any petrol bombs in Stokescroft on that evening. And I think that what Tesco's have got to do here is that they can open if they like, but they were being picketed out peacefully. That's why we've had this riot. The police arrived to make a riot, because in actual fact the picket line outside Tesco's was solid and there's nobody going in there to shop. And I understand, we have rumours, that the police were being leaned on by Tesco's to do something about the peaceful protesters which were successfully picketing them out of the community. And if Tesco's opens in Stokes Croft, the answer is quite simple. We're going to put the pickets back on.
Now, Tesco do have actual links with the Conservative Party, don't they? They're not totally anti-political. Shirley Porter, for example.
Indeed.
Can you just tell us about her?
She was head of Westminster Council in the 1980s, I think it was, and she sold off a lot of council houses to her yuppie chums to try and gerrymander the vote inside Westminster. She sold off the cemeteries for £1 to her chums. She's hiding out in Israel now because she's still wanted by the fraud police in Britain. But she's in Israel, so we can't touch her. Tesco's is not a normal company. And Tesco's have got to realise they have the power to open up in Stokes Croft, and we, the people, have the right to picket and protest outside, and we will.
Okay, thank you. On to our next story, and this week we hear that Project Champion is coming down. This is a whole load of CCTV cameras. It was announced earlier this week. Those cameras, which were put up in Muslim areas of Birmingham with counter-terrorism money, have been said to be illegal and have to come down. Project Champion, as it was called, has been an unmitigated disaster, and the cameras have now been snapped up by the Metropolitan Police, of all people. Now, we're going to hear from a report from Birmingham, to begin with, the West Midlands Assistant Chief Constable Sharon Rowe, and then Steve Jolly, who's been campaigning against this Project Champion CCTV network.
We listened. We said sorry. We got it wrong. The trust and confidence of the public is paramount importance to West Midlands Police. No technical solution can be better than having the trust of the people. So we've listened, we've learned, they're coming down. And I think any CCTV project, you need a sound evidence base, you need to consult, you need to work in partnership. Thames Valley reviewed us, we've learned our lessons, we're going to put it right in the future.
Oh, it's brilliant news. It's really good news for Birmingham, and particularly for the Muslim communities that were targeted unfairly and unlawfully. Obviously, very good news that the cameras are coming down. They should never have been put up in the first place. But it seems to have highlighted a much bigger problem nationally, particularly with the number plate cameras. What happened in Birmingham has really opened my eyes to the extent of the surveillance state that's being built all around us. I mean, I was actually invited down to the Houses of Parliament to give evidence to the Protection of Freedoms Bill Committee back in March. And through the course of my research, it's very worrying what I've discovered. There's currently a national network of these number plate cameras being
all over the country. Automatic number plate recognition cameras.
That's right.
So yeah. What's wrong with having those?
Well, what they do is they record intelligence on every vehicle on the road. So your exact whereabouts, your comings and goings, and information about you. They can track you in real time and record all your journeys on a database. Now, the police say this is about catching stolen vehicles and tax dodgers, etc. But what they're really doing is building intelligence files on everybody. We've already seen it abused by targeting of peaceful protesters, and this could very easily become a tool of persecution. And it's very possibly illegal, and privacy groups and civil liberties groups are in the process of submitting a legal challenge.
That was Steve Jolly there speaking earlier this week about the end, the death knell of Project Champion, which was a multi-million pound CCTV project in Muslim areas of Birmingham. Martin, I know you've spoken to Steve over the last month or so. Can you just tell us what you think about how on earth was it that we ended up with CCTVs being put outside Muslim people's homes when there was actually no evidence of these people being terrorists whatsoever?
Well, I think it was actually the Association of Chief Police Officers that agreed that they were going to put these cameras in place, which is not actually an official organisation. It's essentially a private organisation which has a budget from the Home Office.
Well, it's a private company.
Yes, it's a private company. They told the local community that these cameras were standard cameras to deal with antisocial behaviour, drug dealing, etc. But that was wrong, because the budget from which they were putting the cameras up was an anti-terror budget. So basically they were trying to set up what we see in West Belfast or parts of Derry, where a whole community is basically being watched full-time by the authorities. Because they didn't do it by the book was thrown at them, and they had to withdraw. and the cameras have had to be closed. They had to close them down, and now they've sold them on to the Metropolitan Police to use in the Olympics. Basically, CCTV can be a useful tool for preventing antisocial behaviour, but it shouldn't be being used as a watching tool on a whole community, to criminalise a whole community. And, of course, criminalising whole communities tends to have a bit of a backlash, as we saw in Belfast and Derry over 30 years. And if that's where they want the Muslim community to go, that's what they will end up with if they carry on down this foolish road.
Green candidate for Cabot Ward, Ben Appleby, what do you think about these surveillance systems and the fact that we had all these cameras going up in an area, a Muslim area, where actually there was no evidence that anybody in that area was a terrorist?
I'm with Martin. You know, I think these cameras can be quite good for just policing some public areas to avoid all sorts of antisocial behaviour, but we mustn't sort of gradually creep into a society where everyone is watching everyone else, a sort of Big Brother type approach. It's just wrong. It's Big Brother as in George Orwell rather than Endemol.
But actually, how does a camera, rather than actually having someone on the ground, stop antisocial behaviour? Because, I mean, you know, there's no guarantee that anyone's actually looking through a camera. Antisocial behaviour of whatever sort could still go on.
No, you're right. Of course, all these things, to some extent, just displace activities. But if you take parts of the so-called nighttime economy in Bristol, where drunken antisocial behaviour is very common, I think it is useful in order to, you know, to police that. So I personally wouldn't say that it should be outlawed entirely, but its use, we should be very careful about its use. And I think that clearly this was illegal, and when you think about it, it's pretty obvious that it's illegal. You can't just start selecting one community and watching them full time, as Martin says. It's just entirely wrong.
Martin, what about this other system that Steve was talking about there? He said that actually it's been a bit of a can of worms. As he's got into uncovering all the facts behind this Project Champion in Birmingham, he's also discovered this automatic number plate recognition system right around the country, with something like 10,000 cameras monitoring every single person's car movements almost everywhere.
Well, this was all pioneered in Northern Ireland years ago with the Glutton system used by the British Army. And basically, they, you know, because of the war, there was constant surveillance going on of everybody. But of course, serious terrorists know that they're under constant surveillance, and they know how to use that constant surveillance to evade surveillance. So, for example, the IRA would always steal cars before an operation so that the numbers would not be on the computer, and so on. So there's plenty of ways for professional terrorists to beat these kind of tricks. But we don't want to go down that road, do we? We want to have a dialogue with the community, and as we've seen in Northern Ireland, the Republican community in particular has got behind the police force in the last couple of years, particularly with the murder of Ronnie Kerr. We've seen the whole community uniting behind the police force, and that's what we need to see in Bristol. There's always been a very good relationship between people in Stokescroft, for example, and the police. It's been there for years. That's the way you police the city, not by charging around with your great big boots on kicking hell out of everybody. That's the wrong way to do it.
One of the things we've heard about this week in The Guardian announced, I think it was Wednesday this week, that the Metropolitan Police have just purchased this massive surveillance system which tracks everybody's social networking websites. It also tracks emails and mobile phones, as well as financial transactions that they're making at cash points. This is a way of sort of building up social networks, and basically many of these systems have got back ends which fit into so that the police can watch whole networks of people. This is almost like the Big Brother's brain is being started off in Scotland Yard.
And the Iraqi resistance have a quite simple way of dealing with this. They don't touch anything electronic. They just stick with...
That actually it may be a waste of money, this system?
Of course. Serious terrorists who are dedicated to their cause, or freedom fighters, whatever you want to call them, will always find a way around this. The Taliban, for example, have invented bombs which have no metal in them at all and are absolutely undetectable by the NATO forces, which is why they're taking such a hammering.
Yeah, the software's called GeoTime. It's very expensive.
I don't know what the Taliban call their stuff, but it's better than what they're doing.
Okay. Ben Appleby, what are your thoughts about GeoTime software? This is the thing that way the police are going, is they can sit in front of a computer screen and monitor people's, every time they use a cash point, whenever they're on Facebook or one of the other social networking sites, and it can also track where their mobile phones are.
Sounds horrible, doesn't it?
Everybody. I mean, this is not just criminal suspects. This is absolutely everybody.
Yeah, no, it just...
And if you're a serious criminal, of course, you sit on Facebook telling everybody what you're up to, don't you?
Well, yeah. I sometimes think we address these problems from the wrong end. You know, maybe it's because I'm a green that I see it slightly differently. And this is a prime example of going for the symptoms rather than curing the problems. We know what the problems that we face as a society are. And does a system like this do anything to actually address the problem?
So what, rather than geotime software to surveil everybody, what would the Green Party do then?
Well, I'm afraid I'm a mere candidate for Cottam and a member, so I can't speak with great authority on what the Green Party would do. I can only say what I would do and what the problems are. And I think we just need to get back to the good old human quality of beginning to communicate properly with each other and not be suspicious of each other, and start to identify the problems that we face and try to agree how we're going to address them, but also try to even out some of the huge imbalances that we face. You know, one of the great problems that we face is the allocation of resources. And everyone in Britain in world terms is extremely rich, because we all live in a well-developed society, but most people in the world don't have that. And as time passes, this problem is going to get worse. So this is why social justice and environmental justice are completely linked, and that's the core of Green Party belief, that you can't have one without the other. The two things are linked, and by addressing the problems that the planet as a planet faces, you will also address some of these human problems along the way. And so social justice, environmental justice, linked. And we are going in the wrong direction. You know, it's one of the great tragedies of the Labour Party's term in office, that the disparities between the haves and have-nots in British society increased, not decreased. I know that they will point to the have-nots have got more than they did. It doesn't matter. What we need is a more even society in the UK, but we need a more even society in the world as well.
Martin, old Labour Oxford economist, I'd like to hear what you have to say, because actually this whole change with the war on terror and the very subtle swap between innocent until proven guilty over to guilty until proven innocent is a very subtle thing that's been happening very gradually, like a sort of drip effect, actually happened under a Labour Party government.
It did, and I'm only a foot soldier. I'm as angry about these things as you are. We need to change the electoral system so that we're not scratching each other's eyes.
Well, you had a go at that and you failed.
Not in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, yeah? Don't forget that the whole world isn't England. And what we're going to find in England as we go forward, if the Tories, for example, win the next election but they don't win 50% of the votes in England, we're not going to call it legitimate. We're going to say that's not a legitimate government and we're not going to obey it.
Okay, Ben Appleby, could you just round up on this one? Just tell us what you think should happen. Rather than spending this money on geotime super software, how would you like to see it spent?
Wow. Well, maybe there's not enough money quite to do everything I'd like, but if we're going to just start by making some changes to the constitution in the UK, you know, We've talked about AV. It's not enough. You know, look at the mess in the House of Lords. There's been more Lords, 175 new Lords, I think it is, that Cameron's appointed. Why? You know, if you put patronage...
Because he can, I think.
Well, exactly.
Say.
If you put patronage into the hands of somebody, it's... You can't. I'm not saying that Cameron's corrupt, but it's not ideal, is it? You know, we need a system where people decide who represents them, and that means massive reform in the House of Lords. It started by Labour, but what a mess they made. Then, you know, you go on, Martin's mentioned Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, but, you know, that's a mess too, because the relationship with England is so unclear, and you've got Scottish MPs voting on English only matters and Welsh MPs voting on English only matters and Irish MPs voting on English only matters. You know, why are we not getting more regionalism, more localism through the system? And why are we not getting better representation? We're still getting the same old tired politics and politicians representing the same interest groups, and we need progression, and we need a progressive view. We've got huge problems to tackle. I know this is, you know, not going to come from the money that the Met is spending on this camera system, but it's these sorts of ideas that we need to be talking about. You know, we face all sorts of problems in our society, and we're just scratching the surface.
Okay, well, Marina Morris is with us. She's come along with a report this week on food. I mean, this is really thinking, I suppose, about the Tesco business. But Marina, what have you got for us this week?
According to a study commissioned by the United Nations Food Agency, about one third, or around 1.3 billion tons per year, of all food produced globally for human consumption goes to waste. It recommends that developing countries should improve production and distribution to stop losing so much food, and that industrialized countries must stop throwing so much away. Consumers in rich countries waste almost as much food to hungry 22 million tons as the entire net food production of sub-Saharan Africa. The report, entitled Global Food Losses and Food Waste, has a different analysis of the problem for different types of economy. Every year, industrialized countries waste 670 million tons. Developing countries lose 630 million tons. Losses happen during the production, processing, and distribution of food. They affect developing countries worst. The answer is to improve technology and infrastructure, the study says. Food waste is a big issue in industrialized countries. It is mainly due to retailers and consumers throwing perfect edible food into the bin. The report cites an example of a farm producing carrots for Asda, where more than a quarter of perfectly edible carrots are rejected and sent for animal feed due to cosmetic reasons. Waste amount to around 100 kilogram per consumer year in Europe and North America. Consumers in sub-Saharan Africa and most of Asia each throw away just 6 to 11 kilograms per year. Food waste and losses squander significant resources of water, land, energy, and labor, and contribute to greenhouse gas emission. Agricultural commodity prices are increasing drastically. This corn more than 80% higher, and wheat around 50% higher in price than this was last year this time. Probably affected by major droughts and flooding across large part of the globe last summer. According to Oxfam, food is now 83% more expensive than in 2005, and widespread food riots are happening across the globe. Fighting hunger is the first of 8 Millennium Development Goals that World Nations set 10 years ago. According to United Nations, two-thirds of the world's undernourished live in just in 7 countries: Bangladesh, China, India, Indonesia, Pakistan, and Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia. The proportion of undernourished people is highest in sub-Saharan Africa, 30% of the continent's population. Many countries where significant parts of the population are hungry have food surpluses, which are exported or fed to animals for consumption by the wealthy people.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Ben Appleby's with me from the Green Party. He stood as a candidate in the Cabot ward. Ben, what are your thoughts about that report? I mean, we're hearing also here that one of the most shocking figures Marina came up with there was the 80% increase in corn prices and 50% increase in wheat prices over the year. You know, where is this all heading? Because it looks like, I mean, you know, she was also mentioning food riots there in other parts of the world. Isn't it just a matter of time before we get the same kind of problems here, with people simply not being able to afford enough food to feed themselves?
It's fascinating, isn't it? In the UK, we spend only a very relatively small proportion of our income on food, so we are probably quite a long way off food riots, in fact, because effectively we're quite rich. In other parts of the world where not only is food subsidised by governments, but they, even at subsidised costs, the people are spending a very high proportion of their income on food, clearly it's a significant problem. And it links into, let's call it, the global investment community. There's no doubt that many hedge funds now are investing in agricultural commodities, and they're all arguing that this has got this is not affecting the price. But you know, my own personal view is that it's got to. I mean, any commodity is limited in what's available. If you pour money into it, it's a fact of life. The price goes up. So I just don't buy this argument that global investment community, that they are nothing, they've got no responsibility for the prices. I think they have. I think it's a very, very serious problem. And I actually think it's significantly worse than that report has said, because what's happening at the moment is as more and more people around the world move to a Western diet, which means eating more meat, more, if you think that soya produced going into a chicken or a pig, is that soya wasted by going into the chicken or pig? I.e., that conversion factor, taking vegetable protein and turning it into animal protein, is a significant additional. It means more and more food needs to be produced to get the same number of calories for human consumption.
Well, old Labour economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about this? I know, and you will probably tell us, that actually some of the increases in prices are just purely come through speculation.
Indeed. Well, I agree with what Ben's just said. A lot of it is through speculation, because the Commodities Futures Exchange in Chicago was deregulated a few years ago. Previously, it had been regulated, and we didn't have these spikes in prices. The other thing, of course, is what people have got to recognise, that food all over the world is not a free market good. The United States, years ago, decided that they were going to outproduce everybody else by subsidising their agriculture in order to force everybody, basically, to eat their stuff. For geopolitical reasons, so that when Bangladesh comes to the United Nations to vote on Iraq, they say, you do realise that we supply half your food supply because we've subsidised our farmers to supply you, which of course is then presented as some kind of philanthropic activity. The Common Agricultural Policy was set up in the European Union in the 1940s. Otherwise, we would all be eating American stuff. Now, in other words, what we're dealing with here is an absolutely rigged market, and we could rig it to feed people, or we could rig it to keep the speculators happy. We're rigging it in the latter. In the latter mode at the moment. This maldistribution of food, as Marina pointed out, where you're growing food in a country but and people haven't got enough to eat, but you're exporting it. This is Shades of Ireland in the 1840s. It's got to stop. Every country is entitled to food security. We're entitled to it in this country, and the only reason we keep our agriculture, of course, is because of the Second World War. Suddenly we realise we can't actually import everything. We're surrounded by U-boats. We need food security. So do other places. Food security is an absolutely vital part of national sovereignty for any country, and that everybody should be allowed to pursue their own agricultural policies to look after their own farmers and their own people without being bullied about it. Basically, subsidised exports by the US and giveaways by the USAID destroy local farming. You don't want to do that in any rational world. You want to build up local small farmers everywhere. We moved from having most people living on the land to most people living in cities a couple of years ago. We just tipped over. Now, if we've got any sense, we won't want to go much further down this road. We need to stabilise the rural way of life in developing countries so that people have enough to eat, they have healthcare, they have education. That's the way forward. But, of course, you've got to fight for it.
Okay, on to our next story. And the disabled were in the hardest hit march against the cuts this week. Around 10,000 disabled people, many in wheelchairs, marched through London in the hardest hit march, calling to an end to the harassment and benefit cuts for the disabled. I mean, we had a story a few weeks ago, didn't we, about a group of disabled people from Bristol who had failed to get a meeting with David Cameron, who'd refused to meet with them to discuss some of what they describe as harassment of disabled people. Now, this sounds pretty horrible. Ben, what are your thoughts on this story?
Well, it is pretty horrible, isn't it? It's part of the cuts agenda, and it's just the way these cuts are coming out. They hit the most vulnerable in society, and this is an example of precisely that. Now, whether or not these cuts are necessary, I mean, Martin's the economist, but you look at Ireland.
They're not.
Oh, sorry. You look at Ireland, look at Greece. They've both had big cuts, but the problem is it affects their GDP, so the size of their economy shrinks as well. and therefore they need even more cuts. So if you've got an underlying economy that's strong, then some degree of government expenditure cutting can work. But if your underlying economy is weak and you cut, it just makes it worse. And it is the way these cuts are being done hits hardest at the bottom of society. The most vulnerable.
Martin, are these cuts you say they are not necessary?
No, because what's going to happen as we go forward, the deficit is increasing, and the bond market vultures are already flagging up to Cameron and Clegg that if they carry on down this road, they will downgrade Britain's debt rating.
So what you're effectively saying is Clegg, Cameron and Osborne are deciding to bash disabled people.
No, that's just incidental. That what they're doing is wrecking the economy because of their ancient ideas about economics. They really believe in this free market fantasy stuff. Frankly, that's been absolutely discredited, but they're still coming out with it. And of course they're still coming out with it because we're a capitalist society. People have been had this stuff dinned into them since they were small. You know, this is your pocket money, this is all you've got. Now, in actual fact, I used to teach A-level economics, and in actual fact it doesn't work like that. The textbook has been thrown away 30 years ago by Margaret Thatcher, but it needs to be taken out of the waste paper basket, and they need to have another look at it.
Now,
where they're going is going to wreck the British economy.
But Greece is in the news this week. They've had another bailout, and also I think a large strike, if not a national strike. All of their electricity workers have been on strike. There's been massive strikes in Greece, and in fact one of the strikes by air traffic controllers earlier this year was put down, stopped by the army.
Yes, and of course, as Ben pointed out, Greece, Portugal, Ireland are cutting, and as they cut, their deficit gets bigger, because that's what happens if you try and cut like this. And there is no way out down that road. What will have to happen is that the banks will have to take the hit. The German banks, the City of London. The City of London, for example, is exposed to $200 billion of Irish debt. The Irish should repudiate that debt. That means that the debt then lands on George Osborne's desk, $200 billion for the private banks. Are you going to bail them out? The answer is no. We should be winding up the private banks and replacing them with a publicly managed system. And we're not there yet, because we haven't even begun to discuss what needs to be done yet, because the political system's broke and we can't actually start to talk about it. The Labour Party is still at sixes and sevens about this. On this programme every week, I try and push them in the right direction.
The final story before the 6 o'clock news. Well, two stories. It rolled into one here, really. The Royal College of GPs has warned David Cameron that the health reforms may completely wreck the National Health Service. And also we hear that elderly people will be guaranteed a minimum level of council help under plans for the most radical overhaul of social care in 60 years. This is the Law Commission saying that basically that elderly care must be reformed. So here's two groups of people, the elderly people and patients. Martin, can you just give us your take on this? Both of whom we're being told are going to be hit quite badly.
So isn't it interesting that we've got to reform the health service and we've got to reform elderly care, meanwhile we're not going to reform the banks? They're just allowed to get on with whatever the hell they want to do. I mean, this is all wrong. We've got to stop this persecution of the bottom 50% of the society, and we've got to turn the heat on the top 10%. And don't forget that a lot of these reforms, supposedly saving money, will not save money. If you're trying to make disabled people into work, you need to support them. Even if you set up businesses for them to work in, you've got to subsidise them. None of this is going to save money. It's all ideological nonsense.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, who was Green candidate for Cabot Ward in the recent City Council elections. That's Ben Appleby. After the news, Princess Diana's tissue samples were swapped at the post-mortem, and she had almost no injuries in the crash itself. Further revelations on the 1997 demise of Princess Diana this week, and we hear from the author of a new book, The British Cover-Up, by Australian writer John Morgan. Also, following the 7/7 inquest, we have another untold story that was not touched. That is the Israeli CCTV firm in charge of London's underground security at the time of the London bombings. And finally, Bristol City Council's statement on potassium iodate, as well as the Speaker's Corner. People will be here after the news.
It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol